At the early stage, I have two things. One's called 75 and Sunny Labs, and one's called 75 and Sunny Ventures. And yes, when I moved from Seattle back to LA, I named my firm 75 and Sunny, in nod to the weather in LA.
You were really burned here in Seattle.
It was 15 dark years, literally and figuratively. No, I love Seattle.
Hi, and welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook. My colleague Todd Bishop is off this week. We're coming to you from GeekWire in Seattle, where we report each day on what's happening around us in technology, science, and innovation. What happens here matters everywhere, as we like to say. And every week on the show, we talk about some of the biggest and most interesting stories we've been covering. This week, I'm excited to welcome to the show Spencer Roscoff, the angel investor, former Zillow CEO, who made some waves this week in the business world with an announcement that a SPAC he's involved with acquired real estate company Offerpad. We've got a lot to talk about with Spencer, including SPAC mania, the future of real estate, the housing and travel markets, and much, much more. Spencer, welcome back to the GeekWire podcast.
Thanks, John. Very happy to be here. Lots to talk about.
Absolutely. In fact, I got a joke with you a little bit here because I sent you a message, I think, on Monday. And this has not happened in about 12 months. As you know, I said, hey, we're having kind of a slow news week, but I'm sure something will pop in the next day or two and it'll make life interesting for us. And little did I know that the thing that would make life interesting for us was a deal you were involved in with the SPAC Supernova and the acquisition of Offerpad. And I got to say, I'm feeling a little tired because I was up late last night writing the story. And then I woke up at 4 a.m. thinking about this story. I was so into it and so interested. And so I'm going on fumes here. Are you tired?
I am tired. It's been a busy week for me, for sure. And I, of course, knew when you reached out to reconfirm this booking earlier this week, I, of course, knew that we'd be announcing the deal on Thursday and had to decide, you know, should I keep the booking or should I ask to reschedule, et cetera. So I'm glad to have a lot to talk about. I always like giving you plenty of raw material to cover at GeekWire.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to dive into Offerpad, SPACs, real estate, and talk about everything you're involved in. I can't keep up with you because you have so many different projects going, and I want to talk about some of those. Let's start with the news today with Offerpad and the SPAC Supernova that you're involved with that came in and acquired Offerpad and is taking them public at about a $3 billion valuation. Obviously, you have a lot of experience and background in real estate. What is the appeal to you with Offerpad?
So real estate is changing radically. I mean, it's a huge part of our economy. It's 10% of GDP. There's $1.6 trillion in residential real estate sales per year. So it's massive. It, you know, really doesn't get much bigger than real estate. And yet, 99.5% of people still sell their home the old way. And I just think that's crazy. And that's going to change. And what is the old way, right? The old way is a real estate agent walks around your house, points to the things that you need to fix, to repair, to get ready for sale, and tells you to go spend $10,000 on average to fix all this stuff. All this stuff, by the way, that didn't bother you enough to fix it when you lived in the house. And now the real estate agent's telling you that you need to fix it for the next buyer, which is pretty weird and frustrating. And then once you're done general contracting your own renovation and readying your home for sale, you list it. And then you have no idea how long is it going to take to sell. Is it going to sell in 3 days? In which case, where am I going to go? Or is it going to sell in 6 months? In which case, you can't buy your next house. And you contrast that, John, with what's happening everywhere else in the economy. All these digital on-demand services, Grubhub, Uber, Instacart, DoorDash, Postmates, TaskRabbit, Amazon, all of these other on-demand services everywhere else, every other vertical, whether it's prescription drugs or food delivery or car service, whatever. And it's just odd that real estate is not more digitized. So, I mean, clearly I have a lot of experience in this space. This is what I help pioneer at Zillow. And I just think as more and more people digitize their real estate transaction, there's going to be a lot of winners. I think Zillow is going to do great. I think Offerpad is going to do great. I think Opendoor will do well. I think Redfin will do well. A lot of these technology innovators that are at the forefront of this consumerization of real estate will do well, and there will be multiple winners.
Yeah, it's a big pie for sure. And I think that's your theory here, that there's enough pie to go around for all of those players. You know, obviously, GeekWire has a unique position into the history, both of your career at Zillow and with really the start of Zillow.
For sure.
And, you know, I'm just fascinated by that because my impression always has been, and one of the reasons why you left Zillow back in 2019, I think it was, was the fact that, you know, you had spent 10 years saying, hey, we're not going to get into the real estate into the middle of the real estate transaction. And then when Zillow decided that they were going to start buying and selling homes and get into the transaction business, you know, I felt like, hey, you were, you know, you probably couldn't be CEO of that company. At least that's my impression.
No, that's not really right. I made that transition from just selling ads to buying and selling homes. So I led Zillow through the Zillow Offers transition and got us to, I think it was 12 or 14 markets. And you're right though, John, that through that transition, I had to go back to the real estate industry and explain myself, because I had said many, many times, hey, look, we sell ads, not houses. And so as we made that shift into the iBuyer space at Zillow, I had to articulate to the real estate community how Zillow was going to still keep agents in the center of that transaction and still use agents in these local transactions. I left Zillow not because of the move into iBuying, not at all. I left Zillow because I was tired of commuting from Los Angeles to Seattle, which I had been doing for 3 years because I moved back to LA for personal reasons. And because I felt like I had accomplished what I wanted to accomplish at Zillow. I had turned it into a big successful company and it was time to do some new things. Yeah, I mean, you're right though. The GeekWire and Zillow are sort of inextricably linked because GeekWire was there to report on Zillow's ascent. And Zillow gave GeekWire plenty of material through that time and still continues to do so.
Absolutely. It's certainly been a fun history to track, and it's interesting to see how this plays out. So when you look at the two offerings, I mean, I guess that is kind of my, and I know maybe you didn't like components of my story where I was talking about the back and forth between you and Rich Barton and Lloyd Frink, the two of the co-founders of Zillow, and how I felt, you know, a shot across the bow to Zillow. But I know from an outsider perspective, and I guess maybe I'm not an outsider since I've covered the company for so long, but like, gosh, it really does kind of feel like Spencer's jumping back into the real estate game in a big way. And the biggest behemoth in that business is Zillow. And now here you come in, guns a-blazing. And even though it's a huge market, it just, there seems like are you competitive with those guys? No. What's the drive?
I can see why you would think that, or why you might write that. And it's all good. We're friends here. You know, the fact is that when I took Supernova public in the fall, we took a shell company public and we went out and started talking to hundreds of private companies that we thought would make good public companies. And we found OfferPad and thought that it would make for a great public company. And we decided to take it public through our SPAC. It wasn't even set up as a prop tech SPAC. So we certainly didn't go out thinking that we were going to do a prop tech deal. So there's no personal animus here. This is purely about me finding a company and my team finding a company that we think will make for a great public company and taking it public through a SPAC. You know, I have a lot of real estate investments, and I'm very involved in prop tech overall. As you know, I've founded Picasso. I'm an angel investor in VTS and Butterfly MX, in States Title, in LaHouse. You know, we can go on, probably another 20 or so companies that I'm an investor in prop tech. So I'm keeping busy for sure. But to me, it's all motivated by a desire to innovate and just a desire to create and to build, and not by nothing else other than that. You know, you're right. I did sort of disagree with the tone of your article a little bit. Again, it's all good, but I just OfferPad's competition is not really Zillow, and it's not really Opendoor. OfferPad's competition is the other 99.5% of the time that someone sells their home the old way. That's really OfferPad's competition and OfferPad's opportunity.
You have been so entrenched in real estate, both at Zillow and now with all these other investments that you're you're doing. I guess my personal question to you, aren't you kind of tired of it or sick of it? Or I mean,
that's a good question.
There's so many other things you are doing too that why do you keep coming back into prop tech?
It's a little like Godfather Part 3 when he's like, every time I try to get out, they pull me back in. I am a little tired of it. But I also am quite expert in it. And so I get a lot of deal flow in the space because of my expertise. And I'm, as an active angel investor, I'm very capable of assessing the company's likelihood of success in the space. And so I do a lot of prop tech things, but I also do I make lots of other investments, which, you know, hopefully we'll talk about too, in other spaces that I'm interested in.
Absolutely. Well, we're definitely going to talk about those when we come back from a break. I also want to dive into SPAC mania, which was the original reason why we invited you on the show, Spencer. So we're going to talk about supernova SPACs and whether there's a bubble forming in this very interesting investment arena. We'll be right back.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT Certs Included.
Welcome back. We're talking to Spencer Rauskopf. He is the co-founder and chair of Supernova, a SPAC that this week purchased Offerpad, a real estate company. And Spencer, you have three SPACs actually as part of Supernova. This is the first one where you've actually found a target and acquired a company. Mm-hmm. And just so people know how SPACs work, and these are special purpose acquisition corporations, they essentially are shell companies that are formed and pool investment capital and go public and then go out looking for companies to acquire that are privately held that can kind of get a rush into the public markets more quickly than a traditional IPO. And so you've formed three of these. The first here was Supernova buying Offerpad, but there are two others. And so my question for you is, what are you looking at in the SPAC arena for these other two vehicles? Do you think you'll do other investments in real estate and property tech, or are you looking broader for the other two vehicles?
Yeah. So, you, by the way, that was a great description of SPACs and how they work. Supernova 1 is already public and is merging with Offerpad. Supernova 2 is public and is looking for its target. And Supernova 3 will hopefully be public shortly. And the answer is these are all general purpose tech SPACs. So they're not specific to property tech or real estate. They typically are raising about 200 to 300 million, maybe up to 400 million in their IPO, which means that they're looking for private companies worth between $1 and $5 billion. So that's the first screen that we look at is an enterprise value of about $1 to $5 billion. In the case of Offerpad, the deal for Supernova One, it's about $3 billion. A second screen is a great management team. A third screen is a huge market opportunity. A fourth is something that the Supernova team understands and can help with. You know, one of the points of these SPACs or sponsored IPOs, as I call them, is that the sponsor group can provide counsel and advice and mentorship and help that private company on that transition from private to public. And so, you know, in the case of Offerpad, of course, you know, my team has a lot of that expertise, that industry expertise, but there are other ways that we can add value. And so we're looking for coachable opportunities. I mean, that's really what a good sponsor group is they're a mentor and a coach to that private company that's going through that transition, which can be a tricky transition. And that's one of the benefits of sponsored IPOs.
Why do you think they've taken off the way they have in the last year?
Well, it's a bit of a chicken and egg. There were a couple high quality, high profile SPAC deals, Virgin Galactic, DraftKings, Opendoor. And as people saw those having success, higher quality sponsors entered with SPACs of their own, and that attracted higher quality merger targets, and that attracted higher quality SPACs, and that attracted higher quality merger targets. And now, you know, it's become so mainstream that most great private companies considering going public are evaluating a SPAC path as well as a traditional IPO path. I think it's actually quite rare for a company now to be thinking about just a regular way IPO. And I can argue that there will be a time in the not too distant future where the best companies will choose to go public via SPAC. And that's a huge shift from just a couple of years ago when a SPAC was pretty much a dirty word. It was kind of in the, you know, in the shadows of the financial markets, but it's become front and center very quickly. And I believe for good reason. SPACs have a lot of advantages from a traditional IPO.
Right. SPACs and penny stocks were kind of together, I think, in terms of where they where they existed in the financial ecosystem. When you are looking at this market as a whole, and I know you spend a lot of time thinking about it, there's obviously been a lot written. Fortune just this week was talking about the SPACpocalypse, if I'm pronouncing that properly. because there has been so much intense interest and money flowing into the space that, you know, people are saying it's getting certainly frothy.
Yeah.
And so what's your take on the way that's going to shake out?
I tend to agree with that assessment, which is to say that there are too many SPACs. Now, there are not too many good SPACs, but there are too many SPACs. So what does that mean? It means that a lot of these companies, that these shell companies that have gone public, will not find a great private company to take public before their two-year life expires. And that's the structure of these SPACs, is you have 2 years to get a deal done. And if you don't, by law, if you don't get a deal done in 2 years, the SPAC essentially evaporates in a fiery mess.
Let me ask a follow-up question on that, because I am curious on the mechanics of that. Mm-hmm. So as a sponsor of the SPAC during that period, are they collecting fees? Are you collecting fees during that two-year period?
No, on the contrary, we're spending money, not making money. So to start a SPAC, you have to put in what's called risk capital. And that risk capital is typically about $10 million. And so in the case of Supernova 1 and 2 and 3, the four partners of Supernova put in $10 million personally. And that $10 million pays for legal fees, investment banking fees, deal expenses, like paying accountants and lawyers and experts to do due diligence on the deals that you're looking at. So that risk capital gets depleted over that two-year period. And if you don't find the deal at the end of 2 years, you've lost that risk capital. And the investors that bought the IPO shares in the SPAC, they get their money back. So in the case of Supernova 1, for example, where we raised $400 million, that $400 million sits in a trust account, and it only gets used at the time of the closing with the OfferPad merger. And if, God forbid, that deal doesn't close for one reason or another, then the investors at the end of the 2 years, they'll get their $400 million back. The Supernova team will lose our $10 million, and it'll just cease to exist.
Right. So it's highly motivating for you to find deals.
It is. And there's a clock ticking. And generally, the name of the game is you want to try to do your deal on the earlier side of those 2 years, because the later you get with that shot clock, the more sort of desperate you get, the more mistakes you make, the less leverage you have over the private company in that negotiation, because they know that your time's running out and that you have to get a deal done.
Yeah, going in month 23 to do your SPAC might be a bad idea.
Yeah, so exactly. So it's an interesting game that I'm learning about every day as a practitioner.
And what about the economics just for the founders? Why is this maybe more attractive for them to go this path versus the traditional IPO?
The founders of the private companies, you mean?
Right, the target companies.
Yeah, so you can think of SPACs as basically letting these private companies pull their future forward, meaning that they're able to raise more money, typically at higher valuations and therefore with less dilution, than if they did a regular way IPO. So in the case of OfferPad, for example, they'll be raising about $600 million of proceeds at about a $3 billion valuation. And they'll be on the racetrack in the public markets once they merge with Supernova One. If they were to have gone public traditionally, first of all, it would have taken more than a year rather than a couple months. Second of all, they wouldn't have had the stewardship of the Supernova team. Number three, they wouldn't have been able to issue projections. One of the advantages of a SPAC path is that the company can issue forward-looking projections. You can't do that in a traditional IPO. And if they were to raise in the private markets another venture capital round, they surely couldn't have raised $600 million in private venture capital. So you can think of it as they sort of skipped that series D, E, and F, and instead the public market investors are their venture capitalist. So it's, pull your future forward, I think, is a good sort of catchphrase. And the way that translates to the founders is typically they have less dilution because they're raising more money at a higher price earlier than they otherwise would have. It's also a bit of an arms race, because if your competitors have gone public through SPAC or otherwise, then they have a lot more capital at their disposal. And if you're competing with them in customer acquisition, for example, or on whatever vector you compete with them, being undercapitalized is a hard place to be.
And was that a consideration with OfferPad? Because obviously there's some heavily funded competitors, including Opendoor, which you mentioned, which has also gone public through a SPAC and has raised a lot of money. I think they're valued at about $16 billion at last check. And so there are a lot of heavily funded rivals in this space. So
there are.
Was this something that was discussed when you were talking to the founders?
Well, not so much Opendoor or even Zillow. Again, remember, I truly think of the real competition as the regular way. You know, so every time a home gets listed with, you know, you name the broker, a real estate agent at Keller Williams or Century 21 or whatever, Windermere in Seattle, that's a home that OfferPad didn't buy, renovate, and resell. And Opendoor didn't buy, renovate, and resell. And Zillow didn't buy, renovate, and resell. So, and that's what happens 99% of the time. So those companies are, in the aggregate, are very well capitalized. They have incredible brand awareness. They have 50 years of history. And that's what OfferPad is trying to compete with, is trying to convince people to sell their home to OfferPad so they can do a renovation and a resale.
What percentage do you think, and I'm jumping back into the real estate discussion here for a moment, but what percentage do you think in, let's say, 5 years will be done through this iBuying method on homes?
A lot in certain buy boxes, as they say. So in certain price points. So let's say between 100,000 and 600,000 in communities with like homes, like suburban Arizona, suburban Nevada, parts of Florida and Texas, I think it could be 20% or more of homes that sell this way. Now in Seattle, you know, $2 million house in Queen Anne or Bellevue, like I don't think that a lot of those homes are going to get bought and renovated and resold by these institutional buyers because the homes are very bespoke. It's a high price point. It's a lot more capital to put at risk on a per home basis. So there will definitely be some parts of the country and some types of homes that don't feel this innovation as much, but many parts of the country will feel it greatly.
And I'm going to pop back into a SPAC question here with another prediction. What percentage do you think in 5 years of public offerings will be through the SPAC method versus the traditional IPO method?
Ooh, that's a great question. For growth companies, tech and otherwise, 25%, maybe more, maybe 50%, a lot. Now for slower growth companies that, are more mature and don't require investors to look a couple years forward on their financials to believe, I think it'll be much less. Maybe let's say 75-25 in the case of growth and 25-75 in the case of slower growing companies.
So you're a founder of some companies that are privately held.
I am.
Could you even imagine going through the traditional IPO process again?
That's a good question too. I would evaluate it. I mean, Zillow went public in 2011, and we, you know, it was a good process for us in some ways. In the sense, actually, and you covered it very well at the time. Zillow's IPO in 2011 was sort of like a SPAC IPO today. Now, it wasn't done with a SPAC. It was done the traditional way, but it was a very early IPO. So as you may remember, we only had $65 million of revenue and about a $600 million market cap, and it was only an $80 million offering. So it was a tiny, itty-bitty IPO, and the company was still very early stage. And going public early brought our future forward. It let us start investing in advertising earlier. It let us hire more people. It let us expand more. And so we just did it the regular way instead of a SPAC because back then people didn't really do SPACs. So if I were taking a company public today, I would consider a traditional IPO, a direct listing, and a SPAC IPO. And for a certain type of company, like a high growth company, I probably would select a SPAC merger as the path of choice if it were up to me, yeah.
And it seems like it's about speed.
It's a big advantage.
I mean, you've been kind of known throughout your career as moving extremely fast. and is that really the big advantage here?
It's a big advantage. I'm a man in a hurry.
It's crazy. I don't know how you do it. I mean, I get tired just trying to cover the companies you're involved in, let alone operate and run them. It's exhausting. Stop it.
Yeah. Do you see how bloodshot my eyes are, John, and how droopy they are? So in the case of the Zillow IPO, for example, in 2011, it took the better part of a year for me, the general counsel, the CMO, the VP finance, the CFO. Probably six of us sat in a room for six or more months, focused almost entirely. I mean, we basically didn't run the business for six or more months. And that's very different than a SPAC IPO, which is a 6-week distraction, not a 6 to 12 month distraction. So yes, speed is a big difference.
Well, when we come back, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Spencer Razkoff, the former Zillow CEO, co-chair of Supernova, and an angel investor in a number of property tech and online real estate companies. We'll be back with Spencer in just a moment. And speaking of Spencer's crazy work ethic, I'm going to ask him for some tips on efficiently managing your work-life balance and how you keep up in this crazy world. So that we'll be right back in just a moment. We're back on the GeekWire podcast. I'm speaking with Spencer Razkoff. Spencer, I teased at the break this idea of you being kind of this maniac workaholic. At least this is my impression of you. I know when you left Zillow, no one believed that you were going to retire and go out onto a golf course. You were going to do crazy stuff and build companies, but I didn't think we knew it was to the level you're doing now. I am curious, and I think our listeners would be interesting, like, how do you do that? Like, and what are some tips and tricks for efficiently managing your time to stay on top of it? I'll tell you, I've been amazed, having followed your career for as long as I have, at how you do that, and I need some help.
Fair, it's a good question. So, First of all, I use Slack for all of my companies, and I have multiple Slacks. So I have, you know, a .LA, a Picasso, a Supernova Slack, a 75 and Sunny, which is my investment vehicle. I have six or seven different Slack workspaces, and that helps a lot. It'd be hard to imagine having as many diverse projects that I have going on without an integrated Slack experience across multiple workspaces. Secondly, I started doing 15-minute meetings about a year ago. I saw somebody's email footer that it said this person's name, and then there was a little number 15 next to it, and it was a hyperlink. This was about a year ago, and I didn't know what that was. And I clicked on it, and it took me to a blog post that talked all about the joys and benefits of 15-minute meetings. And this is for like an intro meeting, kind of like, hey, can I pitch you on this, or can I get to know you, that type of thing. Anyway, and so I started doing this, and it's awkward, it's weird. I apologize to people when they get connected to me, and I, you know, schedule it that way. But I put that 15 in my footer for a lot of those emails, and it's brilliant. It is really effective. It turns out that's all you need for a lot of those intro meetings, and it saved me a lot of time. It saved them a lot of time.
Well, we've already broken the rule here because I think we've gone beyond 15 minutes. So I
well, this is special.
I feel really blessed that you've given us so much time.
So then another thing I do is I do something called prep notes, which is whenever I have a meeting invite, like for example, for this meeting, right? So in my calendar, there'll be GeekWire podcast. We'll have this slot. And then next to it, it'll say prep notes. And what will be in there, that's just an invite for me, will be all the notes and information that I need for that meeting. And that's very helpful, especially for one-on-ones, I find. Like if I have things I need to tell somebody and I have a weekly one-on-one with them, I'll throw it into their prep notes next to the meeting invite. So when that meeting occurs, there's my list of things to tell them. So I don't keep a to-do list. I manage everything in my calendar, and I put these prep notes next to all my meetings, and that's a useful hack.
I kind of do something similar, actually. I put notes into my calendar invites. What calendar system are you using, and where do the prep notes appear? That seems like a more efficient way to do it than
The prep notes are just calendar invites, but just for myself. They're not for the other person. And I use Outlook because I'm old and I am from Seattle or worked in Seattle for 15 years. So I still use Microsoft. I still have a PC. My kids make fun of me for not having a Mac, but I use Outlook for...
Hey, the Mac guy from Apple just transitioned over to touting PCs. So it's hip. Well, thank you for those tips. I think we need as many ways to stay efficient with our time these days. Yeah. It's getting harder and harder, it seems. I also want to ask you about the housing market and just get your general impressions on what's going on there. GeekWire managing editor Taylor Soper, who I know you know well, he's actually looking to buy a home in Seattle, first-time home buyer, and he's kind of given up. He's like, it's so incredibly lopsided right now, and just he is really struggling with trying to get his toes into the market. So my question for you is really a question on behalf of Taylor is, what advice would you give to somebody like Taylor, a first-time home buyer that's looking to get into this market right now?
It's hard. I mean, there's so little inventory in all of these markets. I mean, most markets have just a couple weeks of inventory, and in a healthy market, you'd expect to see like 4 or 5 months worth of inventory. So the days on market is 10 days on average instead of 100. And you know, unfortunately, I don't see that changing very much in the near future. I mean, especially in Seattle, where there just are not a lot of places to build in the city because of where the lakes are. And the regulatory environment doesn't really allow for all that much development in those areas. And then you can sprawl out to the east, obviously, or north or south, but then you've got a longer commute. Now, that brings us to an interesting point, which is this whole commute thing is changing, right? So what Taylor should probably be doing, sorry to say, is not buying in Seattle, but buying in Everett or Bellingham or Snoqualmie or, you know, where he can buy a house probably. And, you know, yeah, it's much further from your offices in Seattle, but frankly, he's not going to be in those offices every day. Maybe he'll be there once a week. Maybe he'll be there once a month or once a quarter. And so that's the new life, the new kind of work hybrid, work from home, remote environment that many companies are moving towards.
Yeah, well, I guess I was giving him some crap when he said he wanted to live check out places in West Seattle. And those who are familiar with the geography of Seattle know that West Seattle is kind of like an island. And now with the West Seattle Bridge closed down, it's like truly an island. People are like locked out there. It's its own nation at this point. So, but yeah, he's actually considering that. He had talked about Tacoma and looking further afield. And it's a mental shift, I think, for people to think about how they're going to work in the next 5 or 10 years and whether this sticks.
And everyone's trying to figure it out, right? I mean, every company is trying to figure it out and employees are trying to figure it out. I think it's exciting. I think that being untethered from your corporate headquarters is great for people and their lifestyle. I think it's good for companies. It's allowing companies to grow faster and to hire talent wherever they may live, not just those that are near where their office is. It's a little harder, or a lot harder, I should say, to build corporate culture. It requires real intentionality on the part of the companies to build culture with an entirely remote workforce. It's something that we're working hard at Picasa, which now has 50 employees and is hiring another 100 by the end of the year. And they're all remote and we've never met in person in most cases. And building culture in that way is tricky.
Well, here's maybe the solution for Taylor. You mentioned this company a couple times, and I want you to describe what it is here in a moment and talk a little bit about it, because I think it's super interesting. But why doesn't Taylor just buy, you know, multiple shares of vacation home properties and float around to Malibu and Bend and all these other places through his Picasso purchases?
Yeah, he very well perhaps should. I don't know if he has, I can't remember if he has kids or not. If he has kids in school, it gets a little trickier. But if he doesn't, it's available to him. So Picasso is a company I started with Austin Allison, who was the founder of Dotloop, which Zillow acquired. And Austin and I worked together at Zillow for 4 years. And Picasso is trying to democratize access to second home ownership. So the point is that owning a second home is an extraordinary luxury, and it's life-changing. It's life-enriching for those that are fortunate enough to be able to do so. But it's really only accessible to the ultra-wealthy. But it doesn't have to be that way. And the reason that second homes are so expensive and so few people buy them is because they're mostly underutilized. They sit empty most of the year. And so Picasso allows you to buy a portion of a second home. So you can buy an eighth of a home in Malibu or Tahoe, or a quarter of a home in Napa or Aspen or Bellingham or Mount Baker or wherever you might choose. And the company is growing extremely quickly. The value proposition to buyers is extraordinary. And we've raised a lot of venture capital and we're expanding rapidly.
I think it's a super interesting idea. And it combines kind of two of your worlds, real estate and travel.
Yes.
And I'm curious, can you give any sort of update on like how many people have purchased through this method? Because I think on a prior podcast, and you probably gave me crap about this, I was like, it seems like it's a niche market that it's not a big enough market. But I think I'm starting to change my tune on this a little bit.
Well, COVID is changing this a little bit.
It is. The way people work and how they're moving around more, it's different. So do you have any updates on just like how many people are actually doing this? Because
I don't think I'm ready to announce that just yet, but it's a lot. And stay tuned. GeekWire readers will, you'll have plenty to read about in this.
Have you purchased a share of a place through Picasso?
I have not. And
because you probably have your own private home, so you don't need to share with anybody, right?
Well, so I do have a second home. I had a second home in Napa Valley, which burned down in one of the forest fires.
I did hear that. I was so sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
I heard about that news. Yeah.
So I'm looking for a Picasso. I have not bought one yet, but I will. I will certainly buy one when we expand internationally, because I would love to own an eighth of a home in Europe. I think that would be awesome. And that's a perfect use case, because I don't need to own a home in Paris. That's ridiculous. But you know what? To own an eighth of it for an eighth of the price, that would be pretty cool. And to have my own place in Paris for 6 months a year, that sounds pretty ideal. So we'll see. Stay tuned for more news on this front.
Yeah, I think it's a super interesting idea. And what's next, I think, with the evolution of that
growth
concept?
Growth. We're hiring rapidly. As I said, I think we're at 50 employees, and we are expanding to more markets, and we're growing the brand and creating a new category. I mean, it takes time and money and effort to create a new category. Just like Airbnb created a new category of vacationing, we're trying to create a new category of second home ownership. So a lot of work to be done there.
And it seems like it's way smarter than the traditional timeshare process, because I have family who've done timeshares. I've thankfully stayed away from it, because it's like, it seems like an absolute quagmire in terms of how you deal with it. A big difference here with Picasso is that you're a part owner. So when you sell it, you can reap profits from it, correct? Versus a timeshare, you wouldn't necessarily get that.
That's exactly right. It's very different from timeshare. And from a brand building standpoint, we work hard to point out that we're not timeshare, but we are.
Well, there's
sort of
a very
burdened.
Clear graphic on your website.
we're not subtle. I think the page is called Picasso is not a timeshare or some such thing. Yeah. So look, a timeshare, first of all, the product, the domicile is different, right? So in a timeshare, it's typically a multifamily, like a tower, apartment building type hotel product. And this is single family residences, like a true home. But secondly, Picasso is true home ownership. You actually own that eighth or quarter of the home. You're a member of an LLC that owns that with other co-owners. It's not like a timeshare where you're basically paying for the right to stay at that hotel in the future at a lower price. So here, when the home appreciates in value and you go to resell your share, that share just gets listed on the open market like a whole house would. And so you benefit from the appreciation, and it's in the regular real estate marketplace. In other words, in the MLS, it's on Redfin, it's on Realtor.com, it's on Trulia, it's on Zillow, et cetera, as compared with timeshares, which are in this alternative timeshare marketplace, which is very opaque and illiquid and therefore hard to resell. It sounds like your family might have had that. I have, my wife's aunt has been trying to sell her timeshare in Las Vegas for about 25 years. The 25 years I've known my wife, her aunt has been trying to sell her timeshare.
They need like a 24-month SPAC clock on those timeshare deals. It seems like there's a lot of tailwinds here. I mean, people often say the greatest time to start a business is when you're in a recession and a time frame when it's getting completely battered. Yeah, and there was no industry, as you know, that got more battered than travel over the last 12 months. And so, boy, but when you come out of this, and we're starting to, it just seems like this kind of concept could really just take off. And I'm sure you're seeing that already, which is why there's momentum in the business.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I saw this, you know, we started Hotwire in 1999 and we grew through the 2001 travel recession. We started Zillow in 2006 and we grew through the 2008 housing recession. And now we've started Picasso in 2020 and we're growing through the COVID real estate and travel recession. And you're exactly right. The reason that startups do well when they're started during that period of tumult is because everything changes. And when everything changes, then there's an opportunity for a new entrant to gain a foothold. If you're a B2B SaaS company, for example, and you sell software into corporations, if something changes fundamentally in that industry, then all of a sudden companies are willing to assess new solutions to their problems. If you're building a new consumer brand in travel and real estate, like we are at Picasso, and everything changes with how consumers want to live, do they want to live full time near their office, or do they want to live a more nomadic lifestyle? Do they want to vacation in big hotels, or do they now, you know, pre-COVID, or now do they want to own a second home that's a haven and a recluse and a sanctuary for them? Because they're changing their priorities about how they spend their time and money. I mean, that's why, one of the reasons why Picasso is really well positioned to grow during this period.
Yeah, well, VCs and entrepreneurs love disruption. And I think one thing I'm going to look for, Spencer, the next company you start, as soon as you start it, I'm going to predict the recession that's coming in that industry, like in 6, 12, 18 months after that, and then everybody can short the stocks in that industry
it's
for a
true.
Time,
I have
time frame.
Bad luck in that regard. So both those companies, Hotwire and Zillow, both their industry was the epicenter of a global meltdown almost exactly 2 years after I started a company.
Yeah, I know.
The lookout world.
And look how much, you know, there's strong companies that emerge from that. So yeah. you get some battle scars, but you emerge stronger. Spencer, I know you're having a super busy day, so I appreciate all the time, but I would be remiss if we didn't talk about .LA. This is a media company you co-founded in Los Angeles, and I should disclose that GeekWire is an investor in .LA. And I'm just curious how you're viewing the media landscape right now, and especially you're such a person who's immersed in the media world and technology. What are kind of the big media tech stories that you're spending a lot of time thinking about these days?
Yeah. So this is a company that you helped inspire, John. I mean, I saw what GeekWire did.
So now there's going to be a giant recession in media.
I should short
GeekWire stock right now.
Well, look, I mean, I saw the role that GeekWire played in the Seattle tech ecosystem over the 10 years that it's been in existence. And it helped companies grow, companies like Zillow and Zulily and Redfin and Apptio and Amperity and, you name it, all these great Seattle tech companies that have come out of the last decade. GeekWire was there to tell their story. And when I moved back to my hometown of LA, I wanted to create the GeekWire of LA because I felt there was a lot happening in the Los Angeles tech scene, but there just wasn't media to cover it. And so I started .LA very much in GeekWire's shadow and GeekWire's vision. And I was grateful that GeekWire chose to make an investment in it as well. So .LA has been around for a year. To answer your question about what types of stories are we covering, it's all over the map. I mean, LA tech is fortunate enough to sit at the intersection of media, entertainment, pop culture, e-commerce, fashion. Like it's pretty juicy. It's a juicy beat. We don't have as much B2B cloud as you do in Seattle, or data and analytics, or maybe AI, all of which are sexy in their own way. But we do have a lot of things that are kind of at the intersection of Hollywood and Silicon Valley, and that of course makes for some great stories. And there are a lot of unicorns in Seattle. There are a lot of great private and public companies. And so we did, I think, 1,100 stories in our first year. And we have hundreds of thousands of visitors a month reading .LA. And it's become, in just its first year, the most widely read news source covering LA tech. And it's really the gold standard that people in Los Angeles, but also outside of Los Angeles, read now to figure out what's happening in the tech scene in LA.
Yeah, well, you've done a great job with it, and we're excited to be a part of it. And I know GeekWire frequently shares stories with .LA and vice versa, so we love that partnership. When you think broader than just the LA scene of big tech stories, what's on your mind right now? What do you think are the big hot topics?
Yeah, well, the SPACapalooza is front and center, as you well know. I think the battles between the internet giants is always interesting. Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, all kind of food fighting with each other, especially here in the .LA beat. Disney is changing the whole face of the company to be a direct-to-consumer streaming company and sort of pulling a Netflix, which is to say, when Netflix decided to move into original content rather than just relying on buying content from studios, they dug their own oil wells. And Disney is doing really the same when they decided to stop relying on exhibitors or theaters to distribute their product or cable stations to distribute their product. They decide to build Disney Plus. That's a very hot and interesting story. So sort of the streaming battles more generally between all of these companies. What else? Social media, I think it's a very interesting time for social media. It's become extremely toxic and exhausting. And if when I talk to my 15-year-old about Instagram and TikTok and Snapchat and other social platforms that she uses, it's quite clear that these services have gotten very far away from where they once began. And they're now pretty unpleasant places to be. And so something will happen there. I think new social platforms will emerge. I'm working on one, no surprise, which I'll have more to talk about later this year. But I think there's a lot to be done in social media.
Yet another company. When do you stop coming up with new ideas and companies?
It's all about finding great partners. So, I can give you a quick sense, John, of what my portfolio is. I mean, you know about my SPAC things with Supernova. We've talked about that. That's at the late stage. At the early stage, I have two things. One's called 75 and Sunny Labs, and one's called 75 and Sunny Ventures. And yes, when I moved from Seattle back to LA, I named my firm 75 and Sunny, a nod to the weather in LA.
You were really burned here in Seattle.
it was 15,
really scarred you.
15 dark years, literally and figuratively. No, I love Seattle and I loved my time there, but I was happy to return to the sunshine that I grew up in. But so 75 and Sunny Ventures makes about 30 investments a year in early stage companies with my own capital. And 75 and Sunny Labs incubates and starts two or three companies a year. And so last year, 75 and Sunny Labs started .LA and Picasso. This year, 75 and Sunny Labs is starting two other companies, one of which is called Recon, the one I just alluded to, which is a social network that I'm working on with my daughter and another team. So I'm starting companies, I'm investing in early stage companies, and then all the way at the other end of the spectrum, I'm taking larger companies public through my SPACs.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know much about Recon. Have you talked much about it, or what's the special sauce behind it that makes it unique as a social network?
Not ready to talk about it yet. So you'll have, to stay tuned.
It's the father-daughter project, huh?
It is. And the problem statement is that social media is broken. So stay tuned.
I think we all agree with that. Well, Spencer, I know it's been a huge day for you, and I appreciate that you broke your 15-minute rule for us to go a little bit long here. But as I said, there's always so much to talk about with you. But Spencer Roscoff, thanks for joining us on the GeekWire podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to GeekWire. Our podcast producer is Kurt Milton. Our theme music is by Daniel L.K. Caldwell. To see all of GeekWire's coverage of science, tech, business, and more, go to geekwire.com and sign up for our daily email newsletter to receive all of our stories. I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook.